I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. According to the United Nations, the world's population will reach 7 billion people by the end of this month. Within the last 50 years, the Earth's population more than doubled. And if trends continue, there could be 10 billion people by the end of this century. While the greatest growth is concentrated in poorer parts of the world, most notably in sub-Saharan Africa, populations are shrinking in parts of Europe and Asia. Can the planet handle this many people? What can be done to reduce and rebalance growth? If a billion people are hungry today, what can be done to feed the growing population? Lots of questions, and we have two guests who are joining us today on Radio Times. Jonathan Foley is director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota, where he's a professor and the McKnight Presidential Chair in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior. He's the author of a paper in Nature titled Solutions for a Cultivated Planet, also wrote an article in the November issue of Scientific American titled Can We Feed the World and Sustain the Planet? And Jonathan Foley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, nice to speak to you.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Carl Haub. He's a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau. He's been collecting population demographics of the world's countries since 1980. And Carl Haub, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Carl Haub. Does anyone really know how many people are living on this planet?
Well, I think one of the amazing things is, at present, is that our knowledge of the size of the world population and its rate of growth has increased so much since, as you mentioned, I've been doing this since 1980, due to censuses and a large number of demographic surveys. But, of course, any date or even the year is symbolic.
So, but 7 billion, this is what we're talking about, generally speaking, 7 billion people today.
Yes.
Now, the world's population has doubled, more than doubled, actually, in the last 50 years, from 3 billion to 7 billion. What explains that rapid growth?
One of the points I think that gets left out of some articles or discussions is the fact that population growth in the developing countries, which is Africa, Asia, Latin America, did not follow the pattern of the developed countries, such as Europe, in that especially after World War II, mortality and infant mortality began to decline as, you know, what we might call modern methods of public health and medicine were introduced into those countries at a rapid rate. So their growth rate, from 1950 onward, was close to triple what it had ever been in Europe.
And that's because of reduced infant mortality?
Yes, and general mortality. Things like malaria spraying, immunization programs. In other words, population grew for a good reason.
Are there reasons that concern you as well?
Yes. What did not happen at the same time was that the desire for larger families remained in developing countries. And only in about the 1970s to 1980s did developing countries begin to adopt programs to slow population growth. And I think one thing we also forget is that the growth rate in the world's poor countries has come down. So you know, it has not stayed the same.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Jonathan Foley. And you wrote in one of your articles that today a billion people on this planet are hungry. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, as we reach the 7 billion mark in the next couple of weeks, whenever that will be, it's amazing that we find that about a billion people in the world right now are chronically malnourished or hungry, depending on how you precisely define that. There are different estimates. And ironically, at the same time, there's estimated about a billion of us in the world, a different billion, of course, who are overweight or obese. So that indicates that, you know, we have food for 7 billion people, perhaps, but it's a matter of distribution and economics at the moment about how we feed everyone. So the problem of hunger in the world today is really a matter of economics, not agronomics. But as we face future population growth and heading towards 9 billion, perhaps 10, we simply don't have enough food in our distribution channels to feed everyone, at least to the diets that we're expecting. And that's an important point, too, that it's not just that populations are changing. That's one issue. But diets are changing even more as the world becomes wealthier. And those together will... The population growth and the diet changes will conspire to really work together to demand much more food in the future.
Because when people get more money, they tend to eat more meat?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, the differences between the diets of an American, let's say, and someone in a very poor developing country are just radically different because of meat and dairy consumption, just overall calorie intake, luxury foods, all these kinds of things, which are just much more resource intensive than a much more basic staple diet of just grains and pulses, for example. So, yeah, we have maybe 2 to 3 billion more people heading our way in the coming century. But we have about 4 billion people in the world who are getting wealthier and are moving towards a global middle class, as we see China, India, and other countries in the world becoming very rapidly growing economies. That's putting another variable in play, too. So, and again, this is not a bad thing. You know, we want people to be healthier and wealthier and live longer. All these are good things. But the cumulative impact of more people living longer and living richer lifestyles is adding a lot of pressure to the planet.
You know, Jonathan Volney, we're going to call you back and see if we can establish a better line, because I don't want to lose you, and I want to make sure our listeners know exactly what you're talking about. So we're going to call you back, and we're going to stay with Carl Haub. He's a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, and we are talking about the world's growing population, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Carl Haub, we often focus on countries where there is a growing population, but interestingly, there are parts of the world, and I want to have you talk about this, where I don't know if shrinking is exactly the word, but where you don't see the kind of, I guess, replacement growth that you might see in, let's say, a country like the United States. I'm looking at Time Magazine saying that the lowest birth rate in the world now is Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the birth rate is 1.2. Can you talk about what's going on in some of these low population countries?
Sure. I think there's been a really major change in the way younger people, as they come out of education, college or high school or training schools, in what they see as their role. I mean, I certainly know when I was in that situation that one was expected to get married and have children right away. And today the emphasis is definitely off that. And especially you'll see in, say, in East Asia, in Germany, Spain, and Italy, that having children is not the highest priority anymore. And a lot of that has to do with women seeing their role change, that they're no longer satisfied and have not been in many countries with some traditional roles such as nurses and teachers, and leaving employment when they have children. They don't want to do that anymore. And that, along with some really tough economic times, has caused very low birth rates in Europe, Asia, in Japan, South Korea, and many other countries.
And does that cause problems for those particular countries?
It certainly is causing, and certainly will cause, economic problems. When for example, if we look at Japan, today 23% of their population is age 65 and higher. They project themselves that by 2050, over 40% of the population will be 65 and over. Can you imagine that?
So
40%.
And that raises questions about how those older people will be supported and provided services, and whether you can have enough younger people working to provide all of that?
Yes, exactly. In many of these countries, the younger generation is only something like half the size of their parents' generation. And this will create huge problems for pensions. It already is, really, and especially for long-term nursing home care, for the aged, and for what are sometimes called the old. Their numbers are just going to balloon out of anything we've ever seen.
Let me see if I can go back to you, Jonathan Foley, and toggle from that to agriculture, because in your article in Scientific American, you say that 35% of the Earth's land is set aside and used for agriculture. Can you expand on that?
That's right. I hope this connection's better.
It does sound better.
Good. Okay. Well, yes, that's absolutely right. Right now, feeding the world today, which, again, we're not doing a perfect job of already, we're using about 38%, actually closer to 40% of the Earth's land surface just to feed ourselves today. We use about 70% of all the water consumption by people in the world goes to irrigating crops. And strangely, about a third of all the greenhouse gas emissions coming from people are arising from agriculture or clearing land to grow food. And so, feeding the world takes a huge amount of resources. And so as we look to the future with increasing population and increasing dietary resource demands, we're really looking at a major, major strain on the planet.
In fact, you say, and even dissecting what is grown, that 60% of crops are for human consumption, 35% given or fed to animals, and about 5% for biofuels. How does is this kind of across the world, and what's the implication for that?
Yeah, that's a global number. In the United States, we use even more of our crops for animals and biofuels, much more, in fact. But globally, yeah, only about 60% of the crops we grow are actually fed to people. That's a higher number in Asia and Africa. It's a much lower number in Europe and the United States. And that's an extraordinary amount of food, basically, is not being fed to people. It's being fed to animals, mostly, and now increasingly biofuels. And animals do produce things like dairy products, you know, milk and cheese. And, of course, we can eat animals, beef and poultry and pork and all the rest. But that's, you know, when it comes down to the biology of that, it's sort of inefficient. You take protein and calories in the form of plants and you turn them into animals, you lose a lot of that energy and a lot of those calories. And some systems are more efficient than others, like grass-fed beef is more efficient than grain-fed beef in some ways, in terms of converting things to protein. And chicken and poultry are much more efficient than usually than beef. But right now, if more people eat more meat and we want more biofuels, that's basically taking what could be food for people and putting into something else. And so that's the lever we have in the is how we choose to use our crops. Fortunately, changes in diet and changes in energy policy could help us feed more people. But that's a choice everyone in society will have to make.
And we're almost up on a break here, but it's the choice is whether, what, to consume the levels of meat that we do today?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's what's kind of worrying, that, as populations grow, that's one factor, just more people to feed. But as people become wealthier, they tend to emulate a European and American diet with more meat, more dairy, and more energy consumption, too. So you have to wonder where all that's going to come from.
And that's Jonathan Foley, who joins us along with Carl Haub. And we are talking about the growing global population, what it means for the planet, raising questions about how to feed the growing population. And Jonathan Foley, director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Also with us, Carl Haub, he's a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, and he's been collecting population demographics for the world's countries since 1980. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Hill School supports WHYY. A private coeducational boarding school located in Pottstown, The Hill School provides students in grades 9 through 12 with the essentials for college, careers, and life in a diverse learning and living community. Hill students come from across the country and around the world. They are athletes, artists, friends, classmates, and future leaders. An open house is October 29th at 9:30 a.m. Information is available at 610-326-1000 or online at thehill.org.
This is Christine Dempsey.
And Ed Cunningham.
It took some work, but we made it.
That's right. We'd like to thank over 6,800 of you who chose to make a pledge of support during our recent October FM campaign.
And thanks to over 800 of you who participated in the new YStream service.
We'll invest your dollars right back into the programming you enjoy.
Programs like Morning Edition, Newsworks Tonight, and Radio Times.
Over 50% of WHYY's funding comes from member support. So to you we say...
Thank you.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The music of Sir Edward Elgar could inspire the empire. Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra present Elgar's Enigma Variations. Also, Robert Schumann's Cello Concerto with Gautier Capucin. Tickets online, philorc.org. By phone, 215-893-1999. October 28th and 29th at the Kimmel Center, Elgar's Enigma Variations with Charles Dutoit and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We're talking about the growing global population and what it means for this planet. And again, our guests are Carl Haub and Jonathan Foley. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Jonathan, I think we have you on a better phone line. And my apologies to you and our listeners. But what you're saying is so important. We want to make sure we have a good connection here. And Carl Haub, we switched you to a different phone, and hopefully that's going to work out better as well.
Okay, great.
we'll find out, I guess. Nothing like live radio. Carl Haub, let me just ask you about the United States. Where does the U.S. stand when it comes to, I guess, population growth?
Well, the U.S. is actually, in some ways, it's the envy of Europe, because we do average about 2 children per woman. So that has helped keep the U.S. Population growing, if that's a good thing.
Right.
Certainly, European countries think so. We don't suffer from the labor force shortages that Europe does, but of course, we have substantial immigration. And immigrants, particularly Hispanics, tend to have somewhat higher fertility. And demographers, by the way, fertility means the birth rate.
Exactly. Thank you.
yes, I know, it gets confusing.
No, that's okay. We're doing okay.
So really, the U.S. population growth at about 2.5 million plus per year, it does help us economically. Other people might say less population growth would be a good thing, but the U.S. is somewhat different.
Is the goal, and looking around the globe, I mean, is the goal then to try to maintain the population that we have now, or can demographers even think that way?
Oh, yeah, of course we can think that way. But, you know, when we look at Europe, they have a serious lack now of people in the working ages. It's not true everywhere. In Scandinavia and some of the northern European countries, they have done much better at supporting young families and encouraging the birth rate. But the other thing we have to remember is they don't see themselves as countries of immigration the way we do. And there's a considerable resistance in many areas to bringing in, foreigners, people who are non-German. So that is getting to be quite a hot political debate in Europe and in Japan as well, which is certainly not a country of immigration.
Let me turn back to you, Jonathan Foley, and even going back to the article that you wrote for Scientific American. And as you said, agriculture covers about 38% to 40% of the world's land. Can we expand agriculture, or do we have to figure out how to get better yields?
Well, we can expand agriculture, but the only places left in the world where we could expand it are generally in things like rainforest and very sensitive ecosystems. And that's one of the recommendations of our study, is that we not do that, because that has tremendous implications to the environment, losses of biodiversity, huge, huge emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn down rainforest for new agricultural land. And so we recommend that, in fact, we get a lot more serious about growing food on the land we already have. Let's freeze the footprint of agriculture to what it is today and learn how to improve yields. And we can improve yields in lots of places, but we've mostly focused in the United States and Europe, and places where farmers are already, relatively speaking, wealthy. Again, that's a relative measure.
Right.
But in poor parts of the world, the yields are still really low, and that's where food security is needing the biggest boost. So we probably need to think about investing more in developing countries for agriculture. What we think of as the Green Revolution never really happened in Africa, for example. And maybe we don't want to do that. The Green Revolution had some downsides environmentally and socially that people point out, but we need to do something. We need to figure out how to maybe have a new sort of approach to agriculture for Africa that helps it grow more food, to be more food secure, and to protect the environment in the long run.
You write about better seeds, better fertilizer, better irrigation. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly, yeah. Seeds might help a lot, but also just getting water and basic nutrients to the farms, something we take for granted in the United States. but it's something that's really desperately needed in much of the world still. So fairly basic innovations in agriculture, access to markets and institutions so people who do grow food can get it to people who need it. Those are all things that are desperately needed in still many parts of the world.
And Carl, how about, I'd be curious about your response.
Well, I spent some time a couple of years ago in Zambia, and I was told there by an agricultural scientist or agronomist, I'm not sure what the right word is, but that particular country, it's quite a large country, and he said it's flat and fertile, yet they're not doing anything. And one of the problems is they lack the funding to supply farmers with seeds, fertilizers, and all that. And I wonder what my companion here might have to say about it. But I was told that Zambia could very easily be something like the breadbasket of sub-Saharan Africa, yet they're importing grain.
Interesting. Jonathan Foley?
I don't know Zambia in particular as well as your other guests, but that's true in general, that much of Africa could be growing far more food, maybe five times more than it does today, relatively easily from just a climate and soils point of view. But again, it's a question of money, infrastructure, markets, and just getting stuff we already know how to do working in Africa. But when governments and institutions are not really working very well, when investment is not happening, this is a real problem. And it's not just confined to Africa. Strangely enough, Eastern Europe is a place, again, where we have farms that could be far more productive than they are today, mainly because of a collapse of infrastructure after the fall of the Soviet Union. We have huge amounts of breadbasket lands in Ukraine and Russia and other places that are only yielding maybe a quarter of what they could, and bring them up to what Western Europe is doing.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, that is very interesting.
I might add, too, that one of the big problems in Africa, and Ms. Foley hit the nail right on the head, is corruption in government. And the presidents and the ministers are only interested in the next election, and they're really not tackling the problems the way they should.
Well, that sounds like all governments right now.
I was saying that to myself, Jonathan Foley, but I think
did I say that out loud?
You did.
There you go.
I guess we're all thinking alike here. But let me go back to you, Carl Haub, and even go back to sub-Saharan Africa, and that seems to be where the largest population growth is, and of course this is one of the poorest parts of the world. Is there a connection between then poverty and high population rates?
Oh, certainly. And also, the fact that governments are not supplying our reproductive health services to the population, that's one. Mm-hmm. But the other is the desire for large family remains. And one thing one has to be careful of in looking at population projections is they generally assume that the birth rate will come down and do so rather smoothly and without interruption. And in most sub-Saharan African countries, that's not happening. We just last week, a survey came in from Cameroon, and it's a very typical pattern. The women in Cameroon now average about 5 children per woman, the same as they did in the 1990s.
And why is that? They need children, or they don't understand about birth control, or what?
Yeah, all of those things. Also, women don't often get to make the choice of how many children they're going to have, that it's the husband who does it, and they simply don't have sufficient access to family planning. And as you say, many of them are not even aware of it. So it's a really big problem, and especially when you consider that the countries are very rural and a very poor infrastructure for transportation and for distribution of supplies.
Let me quote something that I read actually in the Sunday New York Times from Helen Epstein, wrote a book called The Invisible Cure, and I'll put this to you, Carl Haub. She writes, many researchers have found that spousal communication is a powerful predictor of both contraceptive use and smaller family size. The converse is also true wherever such discussions are silenced by churches, governments, patriarchy, or Puritanism, birth rates remain high. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the surveys, the demographic surveys, ask questions like that. I mean, who makes decisions in the household on daily purchases, large purchases, numbers of children, and that type of thing. And there's a very high correlation.
Jonathan Foley, let me put a question to you, and then I'll reintroduce you both and get some callers in. But this goes back to the study that you did, that there's a lot of food waste in the world. About 30% of food is discarded. Rich do it one way, the poor do it another way. Again, can you expand on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it turns out that about 30, maybe 40% in some places of the food that we grow never really gets to a human being and provides nutrition. And that's for two different reasons. In rich countries, we lose about a third of our food, mainly at the consumer end of the spectrum. In our refrigerators and restaurants, all those doggy bags and good intentions in our refrigerators. And that's, understandable, but that's something that's fairly common in a lot of rich countries, though not all. But then in poorer countries that lack infrastructure and markets and, supply chains to get food from the field, from the farmer, to a market and then to a home, that's where it's broken down. It's mainly on the producer end of the spectrum. So food maybe rots in a warehouse or doesn't even get to the from the field to the warehouse. And so there's a really big need for infrastructure investments in poorer countries to get food to people who need it, and in rich countries for us to be more mindful of our waste. And again, that's going to be something that's bigger than just a household. It's going to be requiring large institutional changes as well.
And that's Jonathan Foley, director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. He's also a professor, McKnight presidential chair in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior. Wrote an interesting article in the November edition of Scientific American, Can We Feed the World and Sustain the Planet? Also with us is Carl Haub. He's a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, and he's been collecting population demographics for more than 30 years now. Both of them joining us on Radio Times as we talk about population growth and food and a sustainable planet. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let's try Wade from the Northeast to join us on Radio Times. And Wade, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, I've done, some of my own research and experimentation with and reading on, sprouting from seeds, and using that as a significant, food source for consumption. And I just wondered if there's ever been any significant study on a larger scale basis how a production of food in that manner could be done to serve as a significant food source. And there are a lot of advantages to it, both
Yeah, let me just take your question because it's an interesting one, and I want to see what Jonathan Foley has to say. Have you looked at that, Jonathan?
Well, I'd like to know more about what Wade's doing. I'm sprouting from seeds. Well, all plants do that.
Right.
Does he mean like bean sprouts and alfalfa sprouts, that kind of thing? Is that what you're talking about?
That the earlier sprouting life part of the life cycle as a food source.
Oh, okay. Yeah, those are pretty interesting. If I understand you correctly, in terms of growing these kind of sprouts indoors and things like that with a lot of water, again, that could be a very nice supplemental kind of thing, but most of the world's calories really come from basic grains. About 60 to 70% of the calories the world consumes come from about five crops, like wheat, corn, soya, soybeans, cassava, barley, things like that. So we can supplement a lot of that with things grown in our homes, in our backyards, in our cities, but it's really hard to compete, with the land required to feed, 7 billion people our daily bread, so to speak. So I think that's a promising technology, but if I understand you correctly, but it's one that will be an important supplement to our diets, but not a replacement.
And just picking up on that, you talk about better irrigation, better and less, I guess, wasteful use of water.
Mm-hmm.
How wasteful are we? And I guess it depends on whether we're in the United States or in another country, but how wasteful are we when it comes to water?
Oh, gosh. It's amazing how much water we use. Again, 70% of all the water we use on the planet as humans goes into irrigating crops. Right now, on average, it takes about a liter of water, roughly a quart in English units, to make one calorie. And Americans eat about 2,500 calories a day, and that's if you're a vegetarian. Now, if you eat a lot of meat, it's going to be far more than that. So that's a huge amount of water. So what we find, though, is the water consumption for agriculture varies by about a factor of 100 between maybe the most efficient farmers and the least efficient. Israel, for example, is extremely efficient doing drip irrigation in the desert. They have to be. But in other parts of the world, for example, northwestern India, some other parts of the world, we find that irrigation's very, very inefficient right now. Vast amounts of it never even get to the plant. It's evaporating into the atmosphere and so on. So there's huge room for improvement there.
I mean, it sounds like if we're going to address the needs for food, there needs to be more governmental or worldwide cooperation on some of these issues.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to require a lot more policy and government intervention, but as we see around the world today, it's very hard to get that done.
Yeah.
I'm actually a little bit more optimistic to see industry and environmental groups collaborating together to say, wait a minute, there are opportunities here to feed more people, to do less environmental damage, and to be more profitable. There are a lot of companies could find ways to reduce waste in the food system and make that a bottom-line proposition. So we see a large number of large food companies, which, people sometimes are a bit suspicious of their motives. But I think that our motives are all aligned here in many ways, that people want to grow more food, supply nutrition to more people, make people healthier, and help the environment. And that long-term is a good business proposition. So the businesses that are more enlightened are moving in that direction, and I think that's a good thing, too. We're going to need everybody to collaborate to make this possible, not just one side or the other of an issue.
And Carl, is there a peak population number for the planet?
Oh, that's the question that has been asked for years and years. There is no real answer to it. And, one point I'd like to make is the 7 billion figure at the world level itself is not really as meaningful as where the growth occurs. Joel Cohen of Rockefeller University, he wrote quite an interesting book on how many people can the Earth support, and he basically quoted all the estimates. And it came out on an average, and of course this truly, again, doesn't mean a lot, but it came out as an average of about 10 billion. But, I also wanted to make a point that the number of people in the world who are malnourished, a lot of that's due to poverty.
Mm-hmm.
In India, where I traveled quite a bit, they have a program called BPL, or Below the Poverty Line, and they supply rice to poor people at about 2 to 3 rupees per kilo, which is about 10% of the market price. But it hasn't been that well administered. I read a story about a man, a very poor man, who saved for years and bought a fan. And the fan made him non-poor, according to the regulations, whereas his neighbor, who lived in a nice brick house, small but nice, he had paid a bribe to the administrator, and so he got his rice at that BPL level. India now is instituting a program of national ID cards to try to avoid that type of thing, which makes no sense, of course.
Well, hold on to that thought, because we have to take a very short break. Talking with Carl Haub and Jonathan Foley today on Radio Times about population growth and feeding the planet. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. At Widener University, graduate courses are taught with leadership experiences in an educational environment. In addition to academic programs, Widener stresses the real-world leadership skills employers want today. Widener delivers the means for professional advancement and personal growth students seek in a graduate program, while accommodating work schedules through a variety of graduate degrees including hospitality and tourism, business, engineering, and more. Widener Leadership works.
After Steve Jobs was diagnosed with cancer, he asked Walter Isaacson to write his biography. It's just been published. The next Fresh Air, we talk with Isaacson. He conducted more than 40 interviews with Jobs and 100 with friends, relatives, colleagues, and adversaries. The book chronicles how Jobs revolutionized the personal computer and tells Jobs' personal story. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Libya's new leaders say the country will be Islamist. A once-banned Islamist party is doing well in voting in Tunisia. Is the Arab Spring turning into an Islamist winter, or is this the natural course in Muslim countries? Also, how's Japan doing? That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. There were apparently a billion people living on the planet in the year 1800. Today there are about 7 billion people. We're talking about what this all means and how we got here with our two guests, Carl Haub, a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau, and Jonathan Foley, director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to look. Looks like Gary from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. And Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. It's Gary. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
I have a question. Two-part question. One is, what happens when people go to the supermarket, they can't afford to buy the basic necessities that they normally buy, so as a result, they start eating worse, eating junk food, and living unhealthier? How would that affect population growth, health, and the mortality rates? And secondly, why did people poo-poo Daniel Ehrlich back in the 70s when he wrote the book, The Population Bomb?
Well, two interesting questions. Let me put the food question. I guess I'll put that to you, Jonathan, of Foley, about just the cost of food. And, of course, I guess in poorer parts of the world, the cost is increasing even more dramatically than in this country.
Well, that's right. It's a fraction of income, especially. What we noticed is before the economic catastrophe on the planet, there were about 700 million people estimated to be malnourished and chronically hungry. Again, just due to economics, they simply didn't have the money to afford the food that they wanted and needed. Now that number is closer to a billion, so we've added 300 million people to the rolls of malnourished in the world just since 2008. That's about the size of the United States, to put that in perspective. Like a whole country, big country, was added to that role. And that's just really discouraging. But as the caller points out, yeah, food prices are increasing around the world. But if you look, I hate to say this, but in the longer-term perspective, food prices, in a historical perspective, are still lower than they've been in most of history. It just recently we've gotten used to extremely low food prices in the United States, and now they're taking a turn for the worse, a little higher. But people sometimes argue whether food prices are too low or too high. It depends on your perspective. But the point's well taken that prices of food affect the availability of it, but also what we choose to eat. And sometimes that drives us to choose the things that are not so healthy for us and not too healthy for the planet.
And Carl Haub, you want to take the Paul Ehrlich question?
Yeah, exactly. What was that? I didn't quite...
Yeah, didn't he? He wrote a book about the population...
The Population Bomb in 1968.
Exactly.
When Ehrlich wrote the book, and by the way, he wasn't the first. In fact, I have a cover of Time magazine in 1960, wow, 8 years before he wrote the book, that refers to that population explosion as if everyone knew it. But when he wrote that... the world population growth rate had reached its highest point ever, and there was no indication that developing countries were taking this seriously, that they were trying to convince people to use family planning and reduce their family size. So it was a scary time, there's no doubt about it. But because countries became concerned about it, birth rates did begin to come down. And, in some ways it's kind of unfair to criticize someone with hindsight.
Right, fair enough. But I wonder, even looking forward and how fertility rates are affected, if people are more educated and more well off, does that naturally then reduce the number of children that they have?
Oh, yes, certainly. Every survey shows that. But it's no simple solution. Education takes quite a long time, and many developing countries simply can't afford it. And many couples where the country does not have free education cannot afford it themselves. So it's no instant panacea by any means.
And for countries that have, family planning services, do they work, or does it also depend on politics and on corruption and all the things that we've been talking about, Carl Haub?
Well, they usually do work, but it almost always goes hand in hand with economic development. And the point that was made earlier about convincing the men is a big deal. In Indonesia, they had in the 80s, they had a very famous program, and one of the elements of it was that the husbands in the village had to meet and stand up. I saw a movie on this once.
Yeah.
And had to stand up and say what method of family planning they were using. And if they said none, they were kind of hooted down. So it's a bit of village peer pressure.
And did it work? Does anyone know?
It certainly did. Indonesia now averages about 2.5 children per woman, which is less than half of what it was when the program started.
Would that be a shame-based system?
Yeah, well, in some ways, yes. And there have been other innovative things, too. In Thailand, blowing up condoms and balloons and making kind of a festival out of it, that type of thing.
Hmm.
And Thailand now has a fertility rate that's less than the U.S.
Oh, that's interesting. Jonathan, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, one thing that people need to keep in mind a little bit about this, and I know our colleague will is far more an expert at this than I am, but populations grow for two reasons. You know, one is that people have more children than the previous generation, but also that people might be living longer. And so population growth in some parts of the world is not because people are having lots of babies. It's just that this generation is mm-hmm. living a lot longer than the previous, so fewer people are dying. That's what we're seeing in India and a lot of other big countries, China still. And, you know, again, you know, other guests can correct me on this, but I think it's important that people realize is not, populations grow, again, for two reasons, you know, fewer deaths and more births. And that some of that is just natural and that, you know, we'll be going through this transition almost no matter what we do.
Will you agree with that, Carl?
Right. Well, you know, as I mentioned before, the reason we had the population explosion, as it's called, in the 20th century is because death rates went down in developing countries and birth rates didn't.
Let me get, looks like Floyd from Voorhees to join us on Radio Times. And Floyd, go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, yes, my question is, I understand that hedge firms are attempting to create business models in Africa on farming, and how will that impact the local people?
Have you looked at that, Jonathan Foley?
Oh, yeah, that's a very, very interesting and touchy issue. Yeah, a number of... not just hedge funds and investment firms, but even sovereign wealth funds, which means basically countries, are apparently investing in kind of what are called land grabs in Africa. China, Saudi Arabia, and other countries, for example, are literally buying up land or really instituting like 100-year leases, which is essentially just buying it, in much of East Africa, for example.
Hmm.
American hedge funds, investment firms are also looking at this. And you have to wonder what the motives are there. Is it to feed the world, or is it to feed a few, or is it to hedge, you know, on future commodities becoming more scarce, like grains? And, you know, those might be, you know, it's hard to imagine how those are going to benefit people in Africa unless you imagine some of that wealth returning to Africa or to maybe spurring investment in infrastructure that might help the rest of the region prosper. But it's kind of a touchy issue with a lot of people, as you might imagine. But it is happening, and we don't even know how much, mm-hmm. but it seems to be happening quite rapidly. But the firm numbers on that are still not here yet.
Well, Floyd, I appreciate that call to Radio Times. Let me see what Shirley from Bridgeton has to say. And Shirley, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I worked in Central America in the 1990s on several different agricultural projects. And what I learned from that was that it doesn't help to replicate what we do in the United States in these poor countries. So my question is, how do we get researchers, extension people working with poor farmers to work in a low-risk, sustainable manner and look at lower-cost ways of decreasing food losses? We worked with fruits and vegetables, and they require refrigeration to increase shelf life and decrease losses.
Shirley, let me see. I guess that's back to you, Jonathan Foley.
Oh, well, Shirley, thanks for calling. That's really great point that you're making. Yeah, we can't just take what works in, you know, here in Minnesota or Iowa or Kansas or something and just plop it down anywhere in the world. The economics, culture, food system, even the climate and soils are just radically different. So you're absolutely right. We have to make sure whatever is done is suited to particular regions, geographically, culturally, economically, and but there are some basics that might work throughout the world. we do see that, you know, plants are simply limited by how much nutrients they have to work with or whether they have access to water. So that's important as well. But, yeah, Shirley's absolutely right. We can't just, you know, take one-size-fits-all solutions and apply them around the world. And also we do need to encourage more research and, you know, real-world application in many different contexts, not just an American one, and try to ship it around the world. That won't work.
And just a quick follow-up here. I'm thinking of the droughts that we read about and certainly the floods that we've been reading about in the last year or so. Is that impacting agriculture?
Yeah. that's a very big worry right now. Right now, the global food system is just so tightly bound. You know, we're very vulnerable to almost anything that happens, whether it's a drought in Russia, floods in Australia, what happens in the U.S., we're so interconnected, and the grain reserves, kind of the buffering capacity we have in the world, are at all-time lows. So we're already very vulnerable to disruption, and now we're seeing, apparently, you know, shifts in climate that are making weather extremes more common, more droughts and more floods, and the forecast for future climate change is that might get worse. So that's very, very worrisome. As well as issues about, you know, a disease, like there's a disease for wheat called UG99, a wheat rust. If that were to go global, we could be in dire, dire situation. So we need to not only grow more food, we need to be more resilient with the food system.
And Carl Haub, going back to you, we live in a more urbanized planet as well. Does that affect population growth?
Sure, it does, because birth rates in urban areas are lower than rural. I mean, that's just a rule everywhere. However, there is one caution on that. Urban does not mean only cities like Shanghai or New York. It essentially means market towns, things like that. In India, a town of 5,000 or more, where the majority of the labor force is not in agriculture, is considered urban. And, you know, and if you've ever driven through a town of 5,000 in India, the last word that'll pop into your head is urban.
That's interesting.
But still, even there, the fertility will tend to be lower.
Let me get, looks like Bridget from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And Bridget, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to see if somebody could talk about hydroponic farming, and especially now that we're talking about urban farming and how that can actually help cities grow food locally and also save a lot on water. And I'll take my call off the air.
Bridget, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Jonathan, there is urban farming in Philadelphia, as there is in other cities around the country, probably around the world as well. Is that a productive use of land for food?
Well, yes and no. The no part is that it just simply can't, there aren't enough acres. Even if you stack these areas up vertically, it's you just can't get enough sunshine and enough area to cover the amount of land that's out there in the hinterland. You just can't replace Kansas with a bit of urban gardening in Philadelphia. It's just not physically possible. But getting things that require food to be fresh, like our fruits and vegetables, in season, that makes a lot of sense to grow those locally. And, you know, I'd encourage that very, very much. Is urban gardening for things that are perishable, things that are maybe very important nutritional supplements, things that also kind of connect people to the food system so they kind of get a hands-on mm-hmm. experience with farms and food. But also not to pretend that's going to replace all the wheat fields in the world. People don't tend to want to grow things like wheat and barley and corn and rice in their backyard gardens, but those are the staples that feed most of the world. But, you know, keep on growing our fruits and veggies locally.
Sure, nothing wrong. Right.
That's the way to go.
Fair enough. Carl Haub, I'm wondering, we haven't really touched on the effect of wars, and I'm thinking in the 20th century, of course, the First and Second World Wars. There are certainly conflicts going on today. How does that figure into population growth?
Well, it's certainly something like World War II. I mean, it's estimated 30 million and higher Russians died in a World War II. So that definitely has an effect because then you lose, of course, in a large part of your childbearing population. But I think today probably we're not really seeing wars of that magnitude. At least I hope we don't.
Well, I'm even looking at Time magazine, and Russia, there, the population rate is 1.4, Germany 1.4. I'm just wondering if this is sort of a fallout from those wars in the 20th century.
I don't think so now, because most of the people who were involved in it, either as civilians or military, have simply gone too far up the age ladder. It's just a lot of those things I was mentioning before, the economy, and the fact that couples, young men and women do not necessarily see their first duty is to start having a family.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for joining us today in Radio Times. Carl Halb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a demographer with the Population Reference Bureau. In fact, he's been collecting demographics for the world's countries since 1980. And Jonathan Foley, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And I'm sorry we had to keep jumping you guys around on phone lines, but looks like we got a good one to end the show. And Jonathan Foley, director of the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. He's also the McKnight Presidential Chair in the Department of Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior, and wrote an interesting article in Scientific American, the November issue, Can We Feed the World and Sustain the Planet? Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can check us out online. We've got podcasts and email, Twitter, the archives, and of course, Facebook. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.